I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with a special Sunday edition of Countercurrents Radio. There's been some traveling going on. I'm sure you've noticed over the past few weeks that I haven't been on the show. I've been doing shows with other people, for instance. And now there's some travel going on that's required me and Nick Gilvey to trade places this weekend. So we've traded places. And I am doing the Countercurrents Radio show in the Writer's Block slot. And yesterday he did the Writer's Block in the Countercurrents Radio slot. I'm sorry for all the confusion. There's more of it to come. There's a lot of travel and guests and special things happening into the fall. And so we're going to be a little spotty about our coverage, and we might have different times and things like that. I am happy, however, to note that I did do a couple of interviews. One with Jared Taylor, which was very successful on his Radio Renaissance, and that's been linked to Countercurrents, and another with James Edwards on his show, The Political Cesspool. That's also been linked to Countercurrents. So I've been away from this microphone, but I haven't been away entirely, and now I'm back. So I want to welcome a new guest to the show. We've had her on before, so I guess she's not new, but she's new to some of you. So let's bring on Bubba Kate Paris or Kate Fanning. Kate, are you there?
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Good, good. We are going to basically get reacquainted because there are always new people in the audience. I first heard of you through Millennial Woes. You were also on Red Ice. All of these are good recommendations. And can you tell us a little bit about your work, what your projects are, what your background is, and how you came to, broadly speaking, white identity politics?
Well, my realization and coming to white identity politics and what's going on in the world and who's behind it has been something that's been a growing realization over time. You know, growing up, you're taught a lot of falsehoods. So my politics has been something that's been evolving. I never liked the mass immigration into my lands for a very good reason. And obviously, I didn't like foreign rule. So when I first got into politics, I went into party politics. I was a member of the UK Independence Party. After about a year and a half of joining the UK Independence Party, I was elected to their board of directors, their NEC. I was also their deputy chairman of their youth wing. I ran the referendum campaign in a area of 600, I think it was 84 constituencies. 64 constituencies, 284 wards. During the referendum, ran a couple of campaigns, and then got ceremoniously kicked out of UKIP, along with the people that were deemed too far right for my opinions on race and other things. And since then, I've kind of had my freedom to speak a lot more freely. So, but I was mostly just trying to get the education that I was denied when I was younger, really, at the beginning of 2020. So I was going to university to study law, and I knew that universities were just, you know, bastions of left-wing nonsense, but I really wasn't expecting quite the level of the anti-white agenda that I came across, the blatantness of the incitement to violent genocide and the blatant discrimination that they feel is anti-racist. So I ended up now, I'm in the process of suing my former university. And of course, during that time as well, I was approached by a former associate of mine in nationalism who wanted me to set up a charity, but their ideas were ones of setting up schools for which they don't actually have a plan for. So I ended up having an epiphany moment and thought about creating a company that would deal with all of the issues, or the majority of the issues, that white people are facing in our country. And I'm in the process of setting that up. I'm actually in the middle of recruitment at this time. It's a community interest company, a social enterprise. So it works similar to a charity. All the proceeds go towards our beneficiaries, which are the indigenous populations of Great Britain. It's got multiple different operations. There's four different divisions, not including its commercial arm, Our Rights, Our Futures, Our Communities, and Our Heritage. The Our Rights division is the one that I personally am most excited about. It has our policy research department, which is going to do deep analysis and produce data and policy advice based on investigations that we conduct into certain legislations and policy and the impact that it's had on the rights and lives of the Indigenous white population. Then there is our Alliance Watch, which is going to conduct investigations using our open source intelligence networks tools into state institutions and state officials who have been reported for corruption and bias. And in some instances, the Alliance Watch and the Our Rights Division may bring forward legal cases, litigation, things like judicial reviews and private prosecutions, particularly of people like in our constabulary that have perverted the course of justice against the girls that have been raped by these Muslim paedophile rapist gangs. So things like that. Then there is the Our Communities, which focuses on building stronger communities and more cohesive communities, healthier communities that has a membership. The Our Futures Department mostly focuses on families, children, and the environment. We're going to have an alternative curricula. We're going to focus on cultural education and inspiring white children to be proud of their unique white racial identities and cultures, their achievements, particularly in the way of advancing humanity. There is a family-focused department within the Our Futures division. I mean, it's a very long explanation of what everything does. I've got a presentation that I actually use to induct new recruitees, and it takes around half an hour to go over each of the departments, what they're going to do, how they're going to do it. And I think the best thing that I could do is actually release this presentation, because whenever anybody wants me to explain it in a voice note or on a show, I'm aware that it's going to take up an awful lot of time. But the Our Rights Division is the bit that I'm most excited about. Mm-hmm. It also has a History, Heritage and Culture Department, which is going to concentrate on conservation and accurate dissemination of our histories, creating a healthy white counterculture to what's going on at this point in time. It's quite exciting, but I am going to need to start looking for specialists. I need analysts. I need open source intelligence network tools specialists. And I'm going to need people that are going to want to work within the administration, and particularly I'm looking for somebody who might be able to become the division manager of the Our Communities division. They're going to have to like to deal with people.
Right. So how can people reach out to you and get in touch with you about this?
Okay. So you can get me on Telegram. I have a page called Bubba Kate versus the State. And on there, if you leave a message. Now, the only issue with that is I've now been censored from Telegram. I get banned from pretty much everywhere. So there is one called Bubba Kate versus the State Round 2. I can send you links if you like. There is also my YouTube. Getting hold of me personally is better through Telegram, though I will make an email address available very soon for applicants. Usually I like to get people who come through referrals that I can put through rigorous vetting before I'm willing to interview them and take them on board. But I understand that some of the skill sets that I'm looking for are going to be quite specialized, so I might need to reach out to the wider nationalist community to find these talents.
Right. So I have a question here from one of our longtime listeners, whose name is Eric, and I thought this would be quite applicable to you. And so I just want to toss this out. Eric wants to know my opinion of the British royal family and whether or not they should be kept around. And I thought, well, you have some opinions on this, and you are actually English. And so it would be good just to ask you your take on this particular issue. Specifically, have they been good for the English people? Is the House of Windsor good for the indigenous people of Great Britain?
No. I'm not necessarily against the institution of monarchy as a tradition, but the current royal family that we have, in my opinion, is criminal. That is the bottom line of it. I mean, there's another intelligence document that I've got, which is detailing the British royal family's connections to the Saudi royal family, who happen to be Sabbatean crypto Jews. They collaborated together to bring about 9/11 and work with the World Economic Forum, the UN, and the globalist Jew to destroy our own people. So, you know, I'm not a fan of the royal family. I don't believe that Prince Andrew should have immunity for noncing people like he has been given. I don't think that they should just be able to pay money and be above the law. There is an awful lot of activity by our royal family that I would say would constitute as crimes against humanity. So no, I'm not in support of them, even if that's an unpopular view.
Okay. I have another question, which is about Brexit. Now, you were involved in UKIP, and I assume that you were in support of Brexit at the time. In retrospect, do you think that Brexit was a good thing? Or do you still support it? Do you think it's been subverted? What's your take on it now that, you know, some time has passed?
Oh, yeah, no, it was certainly something that was of great importance. And if it would have accomplished what it was supposed to, like getting control of our borders and regaining our sovereignty, then it certainly would have been. But I think with the globalists, they seriously underestimated their ability to manipulate our peoples. I mean, they spent millions of pounds putting out leaflets. They were telling people constantly on the news how the Leave side was going to lose. And yet we won. And I think that took them by surprise. It's why, you know, David Cameron suffered the fate that he did. And it's why they spent years afterwards trying to undo that vote, undermine our democracy, and have spent time now coming up with negotiations with the EU, which basically just leave us in perpetual debt to them, give away a lot of our sovereignty anyway, and hasn't controlled our borders. The only thing that I regret is the amount of time that I spent focusing on trying to take down the EU. I wasn't focusing on the even bigger enemy, which is the UN, which is the public face of the global Jew world order.
Right. It strikes me that the EU is definitely a tool in the hands of globalists, but that once you were out of the EU, and it took a long time, there was a lot of foot dragging, you were still left with essentially a bunch of globalists in charge within your own borders who, first of all, they were the ones who dragged their feet on actually executing Brexit. And second, if you have globalists running your country, you don't really control your borders anyway. It's not being controlled in Brussels now, it's being controlled in London. But it's become very, very apparent that the British establishment is completely unaccountable to the British people and really uninterested in the long-term interests and survival of the British people. I guess it's clarifying, in a way, what the problem is. But do you think that Brexit has helped nationalism in Great Britain at all?
I think it was a bit of a distraction because, like you say, it's buying into this lie that we live in a democracy. You know, we don't live in a democracy. We've got two parties, which are both two sides of the same communist shekel. There isn't such thing anymore as independent national governments. I mean, the closest I might see in the world today is people like Viktor Orban. But all of our nations are subverted by globalists. That long, slow march through the institution, that there isn't a single nation left that isn't in some way controlled by these people. Because fundamentally, they control what runs the world, the money. You know, if these people own the Federal Reserve and then can loan that money to the Americans at a rate that they've got to pay interest on, and then the Americans control the financial system with the petrodollar, everybody is controlled by these people. These people are always going to have this power because money is what everybody worships these days. That's what makes the world go round. And if you create the money and control the money, then you control all the people, all the governments and everything else, don't you? So it doesn't really matter where you live in the world. I think that they keep us distracted with these mock democracies, believing, you know, that we can vote our way out of situations when we clearly don't have a democracy. I mean, look at what happened in the United States with the last presidential election. I mean, you've ended up with a senile old man who's got a crackhead son who was making dodgy deals with Ukraine, and nobody voted for him. I remember looking at the rallies, you know, and there was hardly any people turning up to Biden rallies. And I'm not a Trump fan now because I understand, you know, how he's played into the hands of the Zionists, but still a lot of Americans really did support Trump, and yet somehow Biden won that election. And then they'll go on about how right-wingers are subverting their democracy. It's an absolute joke. I don't know why anybody even believes in democracy anymore. I mean, it's clearly not actually a democracy in practice. How long have the British people said no more immigrants? I mean, last time we were asked was really the referendum. Immigration was a huge issue in that referendum. And they said, we're going to control the borders. We're not going to let any more in. Last year, they've let 1 million in. We've just had like 1,295 dinghy men come over the channel in one day. And they're going to get put up in 4-5-star hotels. Their food is going to be paid for. They're going to be clothed. They're going to get their medical expenses done, their legal expenses done, their travel expenses, all at the expense of the British taxpayer. And these are all fighting-age men from hostile nations to our own, right after the biggest terrorist organization in the world said they're going to flood our nation with their fighters. And yet our government see it as something that they should now be participating in due to this global migration pact, which is set by the UN. A lot of these agendas have been set by the United Nations, and unfortunately, we're all part of that. And one of the primary goals, it seems, of the UN is the complete and utter genocide of all peoples of white European descent. That's what the Global Migration Pact is all about. I mean, you know how the United States won't let in people from certain South American countries because of the risk of them being like MS-13 and such? We're flying them in. We're chartering flights from those countries and flying these people into our own. And this is while our own people are struggling to pay their bills. They're struggling to keep up with their rents. Every time I go into the city centre, I can't go more than a few feet without seeing a homeless white man. And yet I'm surrounded by burkas and Africans walking around with bags of designer shit, with brand new phones and brand new trainers, with the latest car keys in their hands. And you're like, these people have come from the third world within the last few months. Even if they had a job there, a good job, they still wouldn't be able to afford to live in our countries for more than a month. So these white men that you're seeing on the streets are indirectly paying for all of this, paying for this invasion. And it's all directed by the UN, which I say is just the public face of the global new world order. That's where they control their governments from, or the global governance from. We don't have nations. We don't have sovereignty. We don't have any control, not until we decide to take it back.
So let me ask you some questions about the contemporary scene in Great Britain. I have not set foot there since 2017. I'm kind of afraid to try, actually. I'm afraid I might be on some ban list and I don't want to be deported or something like that. That could be just no end of trouble. I have friends who are citizens of the UK who have been hassled when they have traveled, out and back into the UK. I've had a friend arrested because he had a meme on his phone that somebody sent him. So it seems increasingly dystopian, and I kind of don't want to set foot there. But for some time, I was going back and forth, and I had a very favorable view of the London Forum. The London Forum has basically stopped. It was stopped when Jez Turner was put in jail for his anti-Zionist activities, and he's out, but the London Forum is not back. It's gone. And so the only thing that I really know much about in terms of organized British nationalism is Patriotic Alternative. I'm friends with a number of the people in that. Do you have some thoughts about Patriotic Alternative in particular and any other groups that are out there doing nationalist work, both putting ideas out, but also doing community building activities?
I have a baseline respect for anybody who is willing to put themselves out there and speak openly and go to protests and take that risk of putting themselves out there when they know it may have some very detrimental effects on their life. You know, people just for flying a White Lives Matter banner might be fired from their job and not be able to get a job in that particular sector again. And it might be all that they're trained to do. And from that, they might not be able to pay their bills and they might have dependents. They end up homeless and the male gets separated out from the family. You've got complete family breakdown. So anybody who goes and gets into nationalism, I have a lot of respect for. Patriotic Alternative, I particularly like that group. I've met a number of their people. I've been to one of their conferences and they are all very, how can I put it? Very rational, very mostly intelligent, very well put together. And they're lovely as well. They are good at building communities and making people feel welcome, because it's a very hostile world to people with our opinions at this point in time. So you can feel quite isolated. So what Patriotic Alternative are doing has great importance. It's bringing about a better sense of social cohesion within our people. And it's quite a shame that they get so demonized by the media, but of course they will do. But I think, you know, there was a documentary made about them recently, and it really only showed the left up to be thugs and Patriotic Alternative out to be very reasonable people. But it's like, I look at all people in nationalism. I look at the scope of nationalism, and I've been thinking up a multiple operational strategy. And I'm actually quite happy that there's all these different groups, because I don't think that putting all your eggs in one basket and, you know, just going for one type of solution and that type of solution only. I call it solution absolutism, and there is a real problem with it on the right, whereas there isn't just one solution to, well, there could be, but not at this stage, for all of our problems that we face. They're very complex, and it's been made that way for a reason, to make it very difficult for us to be able to find a way to defend ourselves through peaceful means at all. But there are ways and means of doing so, and I do believe that a multiple operational strategy would be the way to go forward. And the fact that we already have these groups, it's like you have Antifa Public Watch, and I think that they work like semi like a hope, not hate. You've got Patriotic Alternative, which are a community building organization. You're going to have my organization, which is the first white rights organization, which will undertake litigation on behalf of the white community, and also do policy research so that we have representation. Then you've got all these political parties as well. Now, I do believe that in the end, there will have to be a political party that everybody gets behind. But like I say, it's, as we don't actually live in a democracy, I do think that anybody creating a party and trying to fight elections is actually wasting their time at this stage. But setting one up along with a very robust manifesto is a good idea, because then, well, when the opportunity arises, which it will during economic times of despair for people, they become more amenable to thoughts and ideas that they wouldn't even consider previously. So I think when that opportunity arises, we do need to be ready. And I look at all these political parties, and the only thing that bothers me is that there is so much petty infighting, and I just don't see the worth or purpose of it. I would like to be able to organize and unify people to work together collectively towards our shared objectives, which is the survival of our people. And hopefully when people realize the real seriousness of this situation, like, it's not about making YouTube videos, it's about actually changing our future through revolution. And I think that when people really wake up to that reality, that, you know, the end is very near if we don't do something about it, I think unity will follow. I don't know what political party will end up being the one that takes the lead in the end. I would like to see a man from our communities who is suitable to that particular role step up to what he should be doing. And hopefully more of our men will start to find their backbone and become more politically active, or at least get involved in the community building, because we really are going to need strong, honourable men to get behind to lead the way in this fight against anti-whiteness. So basically, I look at all the people in nationalism and I try to see them in a positive light. It's only people that I watch and analyse for quite some time that are clearly only a person of disruption, because then I question what their true motive is. If they just go from group to group and cause problems, and the majority of their content is about other nationalists and trying to defame them in some manner, or discredit them in some manner, or get people to believe they're a Fed or a Jew or all these other things, and break down cohesion, I become very suspicious of those people. So I like PA. I like all the groups, to be honest. There are some that you think you probably do with improving a bit, but it's nice to see the effort at least.
Absolutely. A couple questions. First of all, why a man? Do you think that a figure like Marine Le Pen in Great Britain is not really a possibility for the nationalist movement?
I mean, you can have women, but to be honest, I would really just like to see men start taking up their positions. I mean, we've always had men as like the leaders of the household, and I know that strong women create strong men, but it's still, I do think that times of war are times for male decisions. I think women will go into a state of panic, and even the ones like myself with a very limited emotional range will probably struggle with some decisions. Traditionally, it's been men that have dealt with times of conflict, and their brains, they are evolved to deal with these situations much more than women are. I mean, the reason why I do what I do in some ways is to show men that if I can, as a 5'1", size 6 woman, go out there with no fear and stand up for my people, why can't you? But I've had enough of sitting around and waiting for heroes to appear. where are you? It's fine. I will do the work myself if necessary, but it would be nice to see our men find themselves once more, because this forever living in defeat is like a soul death for our people. At least fighting would give them back a sense of purpose and honor. And I would just love to see that day when, like I say, white men realize who they are, what they are, and the power that they have inside them that runs within their veins.
Yeah, that's very well said. I do think that in our movement, there are people who will say flat out, I don't think that women should be involved in politics. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's somewhat impractical in the present circumstances in this sense. In emergency situations, sometimes it's all hands on deck. I descend from people who were pioneers in the United States who crossed a continent. I'm descended from people who included women who had to pick up a rifle to defend themselves. I'm a survivor, you know, by descent of multiple Indian massacres and wars and things like that. And when these things were happening, when the Indians were attacking the wagon train, the women just didn't sit around fanning themselves. They weren't just being demure. They were picking up rifles or loading their men's rifles and tending wounds and things like that. And so I think in a way that the ideal of women not being involved in politics is sort of presupposing a normal society where there's a strict sexual division of labor, or where there's not some kind of dire emergency situation. And when you actually get into the emergency situation, you find that in the past and in the present, you're finding more women who are willing to take up arms, so to speak.
Well, in the modern era, you've got modern technologies. Guns, for example, are a real equalizer when it comes to men and women. It's not like you need much more strength to blow somebody's brains out with a gun, does it? So even a child can pull a trigger. And if they've been taught how to aim correctly, even a child is dangerous now. So warfare has changed because it's not hand-to-hand combat. But throughout history, I think some nationalists have very skewed views about what women's roles have been throughout society. I mean, they seem to think that this very short period of a couple of decades after the war, where mostly only in America as well, not here in Great Britain, because we were still ruined here after the war. I mean, we still had rations for a very long time and we're rebuilding, but America did have like housewives, you know, that would stay home and all they did was cook and clean and look after the husband. But for the vast majority of our existence, the lower classes, the women have worked. Either they worked on the farm, they had to collect water, they had to plow fields. They worked all day. They did dirty, dangerous jobs. Okay, they weren't typically sent off to war, but if they were attacked, of course, they would take up arms to defend their family. I mean, most women, when their children are threatened, would be more than happy to take up arms and defend them if it was necessary. So I think that this view that women just belong in the kitchen and producing babies is very skewed. And also, you've got a range of women that are going to have different skill sets, right? So it would be like saying all women need to go in the kitchen would be like all men, regardless of their skill sets, must go in the trenches. So say as if you've got some specialist nuclear scientists. Oh, no, we're going to give them a rifle and send them to the front. It's like sometimes you've got different people with different skill sets that need to be in different areas working towards our collective aims with the talents that they've got. And relegating them to just childbearing and being in the kitchen isn't going to be of advantage to our people. And then they think that women have never engaged in violence. I mean, look at Boudicca, for example. She left a destruction horizon after the Romans raped her daughters. Nothing like a woman scorned. Hell hath no fury. It's got a saying for a reason. Then there's the fishwives, for example. The French Revolutions, they're the ones that ended up breaking down the gates of Versailles and looking for the royal family with their knives out, ready to slaughter them. Don't underestimate the females. In Kazakhstan recently, it's been the females that have been rioting over the fact they can't afford bread. It seems like women actually seem to kickstart the revolutions when they've had enough of not being able to look after their families because of the situation they've been put in. When they can't feed their kids, that's when the women start to get really pissed off. So yeah, I don't believe we should all be relegated to the kitchen. I don't believe that all women have no place in politics whatsoever. But, you know, like I say, peacetime politics, maybe, but then they get a little bit soft and start saying, oh, let's let in all these poor Africans and they're just like us. So, you know, what I've seen of a lot of women in politics, I think that there's a very small minority that have the views that we do. And the vast majority are too easily manipulated by Marxist propaganda and their emotions and would end up not putting us in the same situation that we are in now. So as if we got out of it and then allowed women to run riot in politics again, I guarantee you the same thing would happen. We would end up with all these liberal ideals being pushed.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. In France, for instance, in the 19th century, it was the left, it was the communists who were against women's suffrage because they saw women as an inherently conservative force. They would listen to the priests, they were thinking about their families, things like that. And even in the present situation in France today, with the Front National or the National Rally, as they call it now, they have a pretty strong female presence within that party. It is interesting, though, that in the Anglosphere, definitely women's suffrage has been associated with drift to the left in general. But it's not necessarily the case with the French. At least that's what I've been told. I want to move on to another question here. This is a question from one of our readers. ABC has written in with $10. Thank you very much. There is this book, The Last White Man by Moshin Hamid, praised everywhere, major newspapers, publishers. Is this anti-white Pakistani British immigrant spreading racial hatred and being praised for it? Is he emulating Kafka's Metamorphosis, a major European writer? Well, I don't know about the Kafka thing, but yeah, there's this guy and he's your problem, Kate. He's a British immigrant from Pakistan. There are many such problems in Great Britain today. And this guy's written a book about the disappearance of white people. Have you been following this controversy that's been created? Or maybe I should say lack of controversy. If we had a healthy society, I think this book would be a lot more controversial than it is.
I've seen articles. I haven't actually bothered to read them. I try to avoid absorbing mainstream media as much as I can because I know that it's purposely written to incite certain emotions and cause certain reactions, which have a detrimental effect on your ability to focus and be motivated. So when it comes to that book, it's not unique. There are a lot of publications along these lines celebrating the decline of the white indigenous populations in their homelands. You will see it in advertising. You will hear it at conferences that they hold. You know, I recently saw a news article which had a black man, sub-Saharan African with an Irish accent in Ireland, and he was gloating over how many foreigners there are. And he's like, oh, there's Chinese, there's black, there's brown, and the white man's going extinct. And then laughs, and the reporter laughs with him. That's normal. We see this all the time, where they are literally talking about abolishing whiteness and the decline of whiteness and how this is great for society and how it's going to be a better world when all the white people are gone. And then if you reiterate that what they're doing is genocide and what they're doing is population replacement, they'll call you a right-wing conspiracy theorist and then print another article about the decline of white people. So it can be a little bit maddening because they're blatantly saying, we're going to eradicate you. But when you say eradicating us is genocide, you're making that up. You're just an extremist and hate black people. You're a racist. Well, I'm now racist because I'm pointing out that you're literally promoting the genocide of my people openly. And it's just very odd how I don't understand it. I personally don't understand it, how more white people aren't absolutely enraged. I just don't understand why they're not enraged. I mean, this has been on the mainstream media. People have watched those, you know, news takes on it, the interviews. And yet white men are watching it and are like, oh, Let's go watch my favorite African sports ball player and go drink my idiot juice down the pub to get my bitch tits. And I just don't understand why they're not angry. They walk about in the city center. I had to go into the city center today and they've got another Pride Festival going on. So there's all that degeneracy. It looks like, you know, a gay unicorn's thrown up over the city. There's rainbows and glitters everywhere. There's men in tiny shorts and kids.
Is it Pride Month again? I guess it's just Pride year. right?
It's just Pride year. It just never seems to end anymore. It never seems to end. It's just fucking rainbows all the time. But yeah, seems like our council has spent an awful lot of money dressing up the town in glitter and rainbows. And I'm sure our constabulary were off doing the YMCA rather than catching rapists. But you know, yeah, in the high heels, there was probably a gay proposal whilst they're in their police uniform as everybody cheers. And then kids get to watch, you know, old men with their balls out and gays in dog costumes crawling around on the floor in chaps with their butt cheeks out. That's all acceptable now. And as I'm walking around, there's these massive signs saying, "Hey, straight white man, pass the power." I know it's just like I'm living in a Marxist hell. And everywhere around me is burkas and Africans. And I mean fresh off the boat Africans. And it's just, it's getting to a point of unbearable in most of our big cities. It really is. And I just don't understand why more white people aren't enraged. They must see the same things that I see. They go out onto these same streets. They see mm-hmm. the homelessness. They see the disrepair. They see the degeneracy. And yet it's like they have blinkers on and turn a blind eye and ignore it. Like it's not really happening. Like if they pretend it's not happening, it's not really happening. Oh, we're not being invaded. You know, we've not got pedos, noncing kids on the street. It's happening before your eyes, white people. Why are you not more pissed off? It just... Yeah.
For that. It's interesting, though. There are signs based on polling that people are being more aware of replacement. They're treating it more and more seriously. So, for instance, there was a poll that was brought out in the United States, a couple of polls recently, that show that Republican voters or Trump supporters, which is a broader category than Republicans, if you poll them, around 70% of them believe in the Great Replacement. There was a poll done in Canada, I don't think it was broken down, obviously, by party. It was just a general poll that about 30% of the people polled believed that population replacement is a policy. It's a plot by the establishment, basically, to replace the indigenous population of Canada. If half the population in America, roughly, that are being polled are lean Republican or lean towards Trump, and 70% of them believe that, and 30% of Canadians at large believe that, that means about the same percentage of the overall populations in both countries now believe that the Great Replacement is a real thing. And I think that's a very positive sign. Despite all the gaslighting, when you notice this, people say you're a racist and you shouldn't notice these things, and then they go right back to celebrating it. At a certain point, it is just utterly destroying the credibility of the press and the establishment that are obviously contradicting themselves left and right about this. It's obviously happening. It's obviously not happening by accident. And when you bring it up and you're told you're a bad person for noticing, that's very, very educational for people. And so I do think that There's room for optimism here. People seem to be waking up. And if we just keep working at it, if we just keep repeating ourselves, I hate to repeat myself. I feel like I'm cheating my longtime listeners by repeating the same message over and over. I'm afraid they'll get bored and go away. But you know, my longtime listeners, the ones who were with me from the very beginning, and there are such people, they've been with me for 12 years at Countercurrents, they're a tiny percentage of the overall audience, because the audience has grown so much. And so, yeah, I have to repeat myself in front of those people in order to reach the new people who are hearing it for the first time. So there's a lot of change going on, and it seems like our ideas are becoming more and more mainstream. Are you hopeful about this? Do you see signs of this in Great Britain, for instance?
Yes. I recently had a video that got released onto Twitter. I'm not on Twitter, but somebody else put it on there, and it ended up getting like over 600,000 views. And it was of me debating somebody at a, well, anti-white event run by BMED, which is a, you know, Afrocentric educational organization, which our governments and are working with and Microsoft is funding. And I listened to their entire conference of all their anti-white nonsense, and then gave out some stop the discrimination leaflets that PA created, and I was with a couple of their activists as well. But one of them recorded it, and I was surprised at how much it got shared and the level of how positive people were towards it. They were like, finally, someone's speaking up for white people, you know. And it was It's quite eye-opening. I mean, I did always think, and I have assumed, that most white people do realise what's going on. They're just very afraid to do anything about it. The problem is that people look at the situation that we're in, and I often do this, and it's very overwhelming. Every day, you know, there's a new article, there's a new thing, there's some other atrocity that's happened, and it keeps you in a state of being too busy to want, you know, to deal with one particular issue. There's just too many problems. It's like when you've got a massive list and you sort of get anxious about it in the morning, like, oh my God, how am I going to get through all of this? So you procrastinate. And it's a similar effect of all these bombardments of anti-whiteness, whether it's in education. We now have the military, the RAF banning white men from applying. We've got, you know, the police have done similar things, or you hear about a 9-year-old girl that's been raped into a coma in Sweden. Then you hear about, you know, how some drag queen has just been caught with 300 pictures of children, you know, paedophile pictures on his computer, and was just been reading at some drag queen story hour. It's constant. So I think a lot of white people look around and just think, oh my God, how do we deal with this? And that is where the problem lies, is they don't believe that what they see in nationalists at this point in time is going to be enough. They don't believe it's going to be successful. And unfortunately, most people are much more concerned about their own self-preservation than anything else. And it's understandable. I know quite a lot of very intelligent people who don't feel that they can do anything about the situation, so choose to stay quiet and just, you know, do nothing, because they don't know what to do. And that's why we need strategies. It's why we need solutions. It's why people need to stop bickering amongst themselves like children and start collaborating together to find solutions quite quickly and implement them. You know, we need plans, and people need to start, I would say, thinking about operating in a different manner than what they've done previously. I know you say, like, you repeat yourselves, and it is important to repeat the truth verbally, but repeating the same ineffective actions over and over again is a form of madness and isn't going to get us anywhere, which is why I say we need a multiple operational strategy that will utilize many different types of organizations and different kinds of strategy, whether that's lawfare, whether that's through community building, whether that's through politics, whether that's through various different means. I believe that that is the best way forward. I mean, it's great that we've got like alternative media and that people are talking about these issues, but talking is never going to be enough. Funnily, I've actually seen old people, quite a lot of old people recently. They're out in the early hours of the morning. I prefer to do my shopping then as well, because there's less of the diversity out at those times. And right now they're really worried about their energy bills. Quite a lot of old people are looking at not eating over winter or not having any heating in their homes. And they've all started collectivizing in these large groups outside post offices and shops and talking about boycotting their bills. And it's very strange how the older population seem to have managed to group themselves together physically, you know, in local groups and organize themselves in that way. Yet the younger generations don't seem to be able to do so. And I'm wondering whether it's because of the breakdown of cohesion over generations, or whether there is just something different about older people's lifestyles where they're more involved locally in their community, so find it easier to get a large group of people together. But they're petitioning politicians and telling them to freeze the energy bills and all sorts of things. It's a shame they wouldn't do the same about, you know, the mass targeted rape of the descendants. But, you know, it seems these days your good boy tokens mean more than everything else.
Right. I do think one thing that's true about older people is that they're less dependent upon social media and things like that. So they have more real world connections. And ultimately, it's the person-to-person connections that are not mediated by these platforms, these internet platforms, these censorious giants that we have now. Those are going to be the relationships that are most politically subversive. They can't prevent people from talking to one another. They can try, of course, to inculcate an atmosphere of distrust and so forth, and they're very good at that. But if enough people come together and they realize the sort of skittish individuals who are risk averse and think, well, I'll keep my head down. There's no sense in taking any risks, making any statements. I might be alone. If they start realizing, no, they're not alone, if the streets start filling up with people and they realize that, no, not only are they not alone, they're in the majority, then that suddenly becomes a situation that's very hard to control. Think about East Germany in 1989 and so forth, where once people realized that, no, they were the majority and they were no longer being intimidated by the state or the enforcers of political correctness, the other enforcers of political correctness, suddenly a lot of things became possible. Revolutionary change became something that could happen virtually overnight. And I do have hope when you actually see people getting out in the streets like that, because one of the ways that the system controls us is by making dissidents feel alone. Social media has been great for years, and this is why they're desperately trying to censor it and control it, because social media allows us to have interactions with one another and makes every man a blogger and things like that. So you don't just have the top-down control that the establishment used to have through mass media, through the newspapers and the television and radio networks. Social media did make it possible for people to start red-pilling one another and questioning the dominant narratives. But ultimately, social media is just sort of a simulacrum of face-to-face real-world communication. And it's nice to see when that starts happening.
I completely agree. Firstly, with your initial points about how when people realize that they're not alone and are actually in the majority, they will suddenly find their courage once more. And I think it's getting displayed more often, but it's going to take a few brave people to go out there visibly in the streets and talk about these things openly. And they might get an awful lot of hostility, but white people are going to see that when you're talking reasonably in public about the issues that white people are facing, which is the annihilation of our peoples and are being attacked by the foreigners who have come here and the odd Marxist, they're going to take note of that. And I think people, especially with the economic downturn, are going to become a lot more upset with their current situation, particularly as the immigration has increased to ridiculous levels. There's been an increase of over 600% of Nigerians entering the country over the last 3 years, mostly on student visas, but once they're here for a few years, they can stay. And we are in a majority. I understand that. And I actually see this as kind of like, you know how a pendulum swings, there's a balance. I believe that there is kind of like a blockage in a way, and a lot of pressure is building up behind this, you know, swing back the other way, because the Marxists are trying to hold it at bay at this point in time. But once that breaks, once that little tiny wall that they've got breaking us from the truth of everything, I think there is going to be an avalanche of realization and anger that they are not going to be able to control. I'm very optimistic that we will win in the long run. It's just, I know that the situation's going to get quite a lot worse for people beforehand.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm very optimistic. I do think that in the United States, the political system is collapsing. Its credibility is at an all-time low. It's behaving in ways that are flagrantly self-destructive and quite insane, baiting China into a war over Taiwan after taking a role in baiting Russia into a war with Ukraine. It's just madness. And as they say, the gods first make those they wish to destroy mad. I guess it maybe softens the blow if they've lost their minds. Maybe it's an act of mercy. Or maybe madness just is the way that the gods destroy us. But our regime is mad and it's weak. And the trouble is, of course, with a drowning man, he's very dangerous and he can pull you down. Cornered animals become very, very vicious and lash out. And they're so stupid and so irrational at this point that they're capable of many, many terrible crimes, things that I can't even conceive of. So it's an exciting time for us, but it's also an extremely dangerous time. And we have to sort of have this stereoscopic vision. Dissident movements thrive as the system declines, but as the system declines, the system becomes much more dangerous too. So careful what you wish for, I guess. We are coming to a point where there's going to be, I think, great change possible, but we might get ground under the wheels before this whole thing finally comes to a halt.
I do think that the people that are very visible today that are leading in nationalist circles are, I hope they realize this too, are the ones that they're going to come for first. I mean, other generations and other peoples will pick up where they left off, but whoever's put themselves forward at this point in time is basically offering themselves up as a sacrifice for our peoples, because when they do start to lash out, they're going to wish to silence, imprison, and make ineffective those who have been effective in bringing about their destruction in the hopes that it might halt it somewhat. It won't, because like I say, the avalanche of anger is going to be very uncontrollable, but we see it right now anyway. We can see it going on in our communities. There's a number of very good people, nationalists with families, young children that are being sent to prison for sharing music, for owning the anarchist cookbook, for putting up stickers saying it's okay to be white. You know, there's people being sent to prison for those things, and some of them for very, very long sentences. Families are suffering. There are people who are being accused of all sorts of things because, well, people wish to discredit them. Typically with men, they'll go with, you know, they're a sexual degenerate of some sort. And with women, they'll make you out to be insane. That seems to be their main modes of action. But our peoples are being persecuted. Those who are putting their head above the parapet are facing some really serious stress and hard times, not just for them, but for their families. And, you know, I think that a lot of people don't recognize that. And before, when you were saying about people feeling alone, there's a thing in nationalism that when people smell danger, they start to abandon the person who's being persecuted because they don't want to be caught in the crossfire or by association. Therefore, they just leave these people to deal with these things on their own. Suddenly, they're shunned by a lot of people who are formerly associates of theirs because they're running away to save their own skin. And when people won't band together as a community and say, this is unacceptable, you're abusing our legislation, you're applying it selectively, you've written it in a very broad manner, you know that sharing music and reading the anarchist cookbook, I mean, 13-year-old boy going to prison for owning the anarchist cookbook, it doesn't constitute as terrorism. But at the same time, they will allow music that says, kill the white man. They'll allow mosques to talk about slaughtering our people. That's perfectly fine, you know. But yeah, people think that it hasn't already got to a bad stage for many people, they're quite deluded. I know it's going to get worse. I know it's going to get much worse, but I think it's a thing that our people are willing to do. I think that it's only a modern idea that, you know, passing our problems on to other generations and not being willing to sacrifice your own personal comfort and happiness so that other generations can have a chance at a better life. I think, you know, it's only recently that we've cared more about ourselves than the future of our people. And I think that the more people see good nationalist, law-abiding people having their families destroyed, being sent to prison for, what, like reading a book, I think they're going to wake up a lot more to just how unjust our system is and how anti-white it is.
Absolutely. I'm a very risk-averse person. I understand people who are risk-averse. I really like a sure thing. And there's no surer bet than offering the establishment a heads we win, tails you lose proposition. And at this point, there are many of those out there. For instance, when people struggle against injustice and they win, well, we win, that we push back the frontiers of injustice. We get a little bit more justice in the world. If they lose, we also win. Why? Because every time the system flagrantly disregards its own standards, every time it says, oh, democracy, sorry, democracy for us, but not for you, all those sorts of things, they educate the people in ways that we can't. We see, therefore, the cratering trust in the establishment. The establishment loses trust by refusing to give people justice, even when they petition it with the most honeyed words and the best arguments and so forth, and appeal to their own standards, and they still strike them down. That's very educational. So no matter what happens, when we agitate now, It's a heads we win, tails they lose proposition. If they give in, we win. If they strike us down, they lose credibility. And we just have to be prepared to make the sacrifice of being the agitator who gets struck down occasionally. And others will come behind us, I think, because the spectacle of what's happening to decent people who are being persecuted is shocking. And of course, they think that they're going to get us into a situation where we won't want to follow. They think this is going to discourage us, but at a certain point, it encourages people, not because they want to be martyrs themselves, although there might be a few like that, but because they see that this system is so heinous that they simply have to set aside their calculations of self-interest and do something about it. And I see more and more of that groundswell of indignation. And I think that we can ride that towards permanent political change.
I agree. I think it's the idea of deferred gratification, you know, some hardship in the short term to secure something good in the future, something better. And of course, as well, it's one of the reasons why I've brought my legal claims forward is to try and nudge the state into exposing themselves for what they truly are. I think when you force their hand, it's and expose them in that manner. It's like with my case, I've put in there that I've been discriminated against because, you know, I called Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. So now in a court of law, they're going to have to look at whether it is a factual statement or not. And if it isn't considered a factual statement, then they'll have to consider that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, which they would have never have done in our courts or parliament unless you force their hand to do so. And I think that's how nationalists have got to think. What we want to do is open the other people's eyes. And it's not so much about, you know, just talking about what these people are doing. Show them up for what they are. And one of the best ways of doing that is by cornering them into a situation where they have to expose the truth of what they are or what they're doing. And I think lawfare is a very good way of going about that because they can't cancel you from the courts. They can cancel you from social media. They can consistently censor and delete your accounts, but they can't stop that debate in a court of law. So I think lawfare is a very good way of going forward. And occasionally, especially if you're a novice litigant in person like myself, you might get struck down, but it's worth the risk. It's worth the risk because if we are successful, well, it stops anti-white discrimination throughout our education system and could get Black Lives Matter considered to be prescribed as a terrorist organization. But it also shows that you can use the Marxist's own tools against them in many ways. Like I'm using the Equality Act, which is a Marxist piece of legislation, but I've thought, right, okay, if you're going to put this into act and you're going to discriminate against me and basically, well, be hypocritical of the own your own legislation that you've written, then I'm going to use it against you.
Absolutely.
Anything that can highlight the disparity and the inconsistencies and the hypocrisy of the left to white people, showing like, look, this is how they treat everybody else, and this is how they treat you. This is how they react when you do this, but that's how they react when these other people do it. Do you not see the difference here and how you're being treated in a negative and unfavorable manner to the extent of actually, you know, trying to promote your extinction? You know, definition C of the Genocide Convention. They're enforcing the conditions of life that will bring about our destruction in part or whole. And making people realize that every single step of the way is anti-white, everything really wakes them up. I've had family members that have been in a bit of denial for quite some time, but, you know, showing them things like the RAF banning white men and pointing out, you know, the white children that are not being able to get university places and things like this, they're becoming more aware of it now. And I think having things like the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, which will be able to produce evidence-based policies and in-depth research on these topics will arm our people to go forth with the evidence to talk about, saying, well, actually, this is the impact that it's had. And look, white people, why are you agreeing to this? You didn't agree to this. Your politicians are running rogue. So, yeah, I do think that direct action, thinking outside the box and trying to utilize the Marxists' own tools against them is a strategy that's worth doing.
Absolutely. Well, we have been going for an hour and it's flown by. I've really enjoyed this. I would like you to tell people out there in Radioland how they can follow your work, how they can support your work.
Okay. So I've been banished from most social media. I am on Gab, but I don't I don't actually go on there that often. My most checked social media is my Telegram page, which is Bubba Kate versus the State. I can send an invite link that you could put on the countercurrents if you'd like to. There is a round two because my initial page has been censored. I don't have Facebook. I don't have Twitter. I don't have any of those things. I am on Signal, but I don't tend to give my number out because otherwise people would bombard me and eventually get given to lefty activists and they just call me all the time. So I can't put that in a public domain. But if you wish to get hold of me, go on Telegram, look up Bubba Kate versus the State. It's a public channel. You should be able to find it. And just ask for Paris and I'll find you. And then I'll DM you and then we can start a conversation from there. And that's, you know, that's people that are interested in getting active in some ways and believe that they've got skills that they can utilize to do so. I mean, I don't want to chat endlessly about the problems. I'm more interested in people want to talk about solutions. So if you've got solutions and you're interested in implementing them, do get hold of me. And you can do so through Telegram. And I will send that invite link to Greg here.
Well, thank you so much again. I've very much enjoyed this. And I hope that we will have another conversation very soon. So thank you, Kate Fanning. It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. I'm very, very much enjoyed it. And I would more than be happy to come back on the show again. So anyway, thank you for having me on. I shall let you go. But yes, it's been good. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.